You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thank you, everybody, for coming to this very timely discussion on the Kenyan elections with incoming OSF fellow Ben. Ben is currently on sabbatical from Human Rights Watch, where he is the senior researcher on East Africa and the Horn of Africa. Prior to joining Human Rights Watch, he worked as an advisor to the Tanzanian Opposition Party, and before that, as a foreign affairs advisor to the Liberal Democrats in the UK Parliament. Ben holds a BA in Swahili and History from the School of Oriental and African Studies and a Master's in International Relations from the University of Chicago. He's also the author of Radio Congo, Signals of Hope from Africa's Deadliest War, which was recently published in the US. In May, Ben will start his fellowship in Kenya, where he will follow the stories of young Somali inhabitants of Dada, the world's largest refugee camp. Today, however, he is here to discuss the recent and very controversial Kenyan elections where Uhuru Kenyatta, ICC indictee, was declared the winner by the Independent Electoral Commission. The announced loser, Raila Odinga, is challenging the results in court, and the Supreme Court will have about 2 weeks to adjudicate the case. So this is a very timely topic, and we'd like to thank Ben for taking time out of his busy schedule to come here and discuss it. The format, he'll talk for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll open up the floor for questions. Thank you.
Great. Okay, well, thanks for having me. I wasn't expecting to get to know everybody at OSI until May, but it's great to take opportunity of being in New York. My beginning work for Human Rights Watch on the Horn of Africa was with the 2007 elections in Kenya and the violence, and a report called Ballots to Bullets, which I wrote at that time. So it's a very interesting kind of bookend to now be stepping away. I worked on the Human Rights Watch's pre-election report, which came out in February, which laid the ground for, described the patterns of violence that are existing now. And in a way, that's a very good pointer to some of the problems that we may see evolving, depending on how things pan out. So I'd like to say sort of four things over 10 to 15 minutes. The first is the different narratives about the election. The second is what's wrong with that and what's wrong with the elections, the election results, and what the problems that poses for Kenya. Thirdly, a brief history lesson about the work that Binaifa Nwodji, who runs OSEA, did for Human Rights Watch in 1992 and 1997, that involves some of these guys. And then fourthly, I'd like to hazard some predictions. I'm at the risk of being wrong, but I think it's an interesting way to sort of think about what we might have to deal with in Kenya and what OSEA might have to deal with in Kenya, because they're very much on the front line, as you know. So there seems to have been two emerging narratives that have developed over the last 2 weeks about what has happened. The first was most eloquently put by Kenyan writer Wainaina Binyavanga in The Guardian, which was the kind of Kenya pride line, which is that the West doesn't understand Kenya, and what we witnessed was a vote for peace for William Ruto, the vice president, who is the sort of main kingpin of the Kalenjin community, and Uhuru Kenyatta, the president-elect, who's the sort of scion of the Kikuyu community and son of Jomo Kenyatta, the first president, who were both indicted for inciting their respective communities against each other in 2007 and who now are on the same ticket, ostensibly to avoid being transferred to The Hague, but also because it makes electoral sense, the two biggest ethnic communities, and Kenya has a sort of very messy history of voting along ethnic lines. So that was a very cynical political move in order to build a majority. But the Kenya Pride narrative kind of puts that to the side and says Kenyans are sophisticated. They're voting for peace. This is a finger to the international community. The ICC has no role. We will solve our own problems. And you all need to back off.
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Yeah, okay. So the counter to that, the main proponents of the counter to that, has been Michaela Wrong in the New York Times, which is a more sort of international approach, one that says that Kenya, in fact, has voted for. This is the triumph of an old kind of cynical tribal politics, and it's not a positive step that the Kenyan press has muzzled itself and has not asked the kind of questions that you would expect the press to ask, and that they've done that and they've on the one hand censored themselves, and then on the other, they're saying that this is in aid of peace, that we are being responsible by not talking, by not raising too many questions, by not poking too hard, and particularly by not talking about ethnic and tribal issues, which caused so much grief last time. Of course, both of those narratives have their problems. The good guy, bad guy tendency of the international coverage is most certainly false, and I think that the majority of Kenyan opinion would reject that. That just because William Ruto and Uhuru Kenyatta were indicted for what they did last time does not mean that the CORD Alliance and ODM and Raila Odinga are completely clean. William Ruto was the deputy for Raila Odinga last time. It's inconceivable that Odinga was not aware of what was going on. He certainly implicated. There were strategic decisions taken about how to pursue the prosecutions last time, which kept Odinga and Kibaki out of the picture. And most people believe that both of them also did have blood on their hands. So the good guy, bad guy thing is wrong. At the same time, the Kenya Pride narrative definitely has many, many problems. We've seen this in the people who work on the International Criminal Court will have seen this in other contexts with strong rejections against international justice. One of the sad things about this is that we've seen very, very high opinion polls in Kenya in favour of the ICC in 2007 to now an election being apparently won on a ticket of rejection of the ICC. So that's a very rapid turnaround and a very rapid slide in public opinion, which I think is concerning. So neither of those two, I think, really captures the whole picture of the Kenyan elections. Where we are now is, or where both of them sort of have end up, is with the major problem being the credibility of the IEBC, the Independent Electoral, I don't know what the B and the C stand for, I can't remember, but the Electoral Commission. And the fact that the credibility of the Electoral Commission is now being challenged in court is indicative of some serious problems for Kenya. The Supreme Court, in a way, is damned if it finds in favour, is damned if it finds against. Because either it has to order a rerun under the Constitution within 60 days, and a big part of Odinga's petition is that the Commission was not prepared, that the staff were compromised, that, in fact, we need a new voters register. And how long is that going to take? On the other hand, if they find against, then there is if they find in favour against the petition and they uphold the result, then there is the possibility of violence and the prospect that we then have a whole load of tensions that 49% of the population feels unrepresented and feels cheated, which is exactly what happened last time. The second major consequence of this current situation is what I already mentioned, the victim, international justice being the victim of this, that there was a lot of effort taken and a lot of care by the ICC and by lots of other people involved with the ICC to make sure that the intervention the involvement in Kenya was as appropriate as possible, took all the steps to try and protect witnesses. There were some problems with that, but to tread very carefully with the the explosive Kenyan political situation. And despite all of that, I think the international justice movement as a whole is now very, very damaged, because Kenya was, in a way, the exception, where the population was polling in very high numbers in favour of the ICC, and now we're sort of back to the other countries that have all reacted quite strongly against it. And the third victim is the media. And I think Michaela Wrong's analysis is very good. She described a press conference when the results were announced, and with a screen behind the chairman of the Electoral Commission with numbers that did not add up. Meanwhile, the Kenyan journalists were not asking any questions at all. And a lot of the substance in the petitions, the two petitions that are challenging the results, were not raised by the press at all. It's been a very sort of very muted performance, and it's a real shame. And that's something we've seen, I think, deteriorate since 2007, the corruption of journalists and a kind of general movement in the Kenyan press to be more and more quiescent. So now I get to my history lesson, which is that I think it's great that the Kenyan press is being muscular, is being assertive, and is rejecting the stereotypes that a lot of foreign journalists were using, and is that people do feel that a vote for peace is good and so on. And I think that is positive. On the other hand, if we look in historical perspective, this is actually the final chapter, or the current chapter, in a very long history between the forces of reform and progression and the forces of corruption and impunity in Kenya. Moi, when he was faced with challenges at home in Kenya back in the 90s, got around the demands of the West and the demands of Kenyan civil society, Maina Kiai and others who worked with Osia in Nairobi among them. He got around those demands by holding elections, but by fomenting violence. So he tried to split the Rift Valley, and he used his two lieutenants, William Ruto and Uhuru Kenyatta, at that point in charge of KANU Youth, which was the ruling party that in the single party regime, and used them to foment violence in the Rift Valley in a report called Divide and Rule that Benifa wrote for Human Rights Watch back then. She talks about that process and about the violence that ensued. 1997 elections, we saw the same problem with ethnic differences being exacerbated, being manipulated, and we saw a big explosion of violence on the coast in 1997. And Benifa and others covered that election as well. 2002, we saw the end of the Moi regime. He was finally pushed out. Kibaki came in. There was the NARC Rainbow Coalition, if you remember. It was a moment of hope. People thought, okay, now finally things will change. And people like Maina, like Gladwell, the Kenya Commission for Human Rights, the Kenya National Commission for Human Rights, all of the things that they were calling for, they were then expected to be implemented: a new constitution, including a Bill of Rights, kind of relaxation, liberalisation of the press, and all this sort of stuff, which began very tentatively. 2007 was the wake-up call. 2007 was when people realised that actually, no, Kibaki's not serious. Kibaki is an ethno-fascist of the worst kind, just like the previous ones. And he had entrenched, people realised that then, and Michaela Wrong's book, It's Our Turn to Eat, just details this process in a lot of detail, is precisely how he entrenched Kikuyu control over the state, was a block to reform, was a block to justice, and he put others put a lot of obstacles in the way of the justice agenda, the progressive agenda, after the 2007 elections and the search for justice for the victims there. So we then, all of the efforts to have a domestic I'm sort of telescoping history here, but the end, if you remember, the end of the 2007-08 elections was that Kofi Annan stepped in and there was a promise by Kenya to deliver justice for the victims of the violence, and if they failed to establish a national mechanism, then the ICC would take over the case. And that's what happened. But the people who are principally responsible for making sure that the national justice system, the national mechanism, failed are William Ruto and Uhuru Kenyatta. And there was an enormous maize scandal, the proceeds of which were used to pay all of the MPs off three times to stymie every bill that came that tried to establish a national tribunal to address the, to take the cases of the post-election violence, because, of course, the police was implicated, the government was implicated. We needed some kind of system, some kind of court that was insulated. So they were front and centre in making sure that didn't happen. Now, Raila Odinga, of course, is not entirely clean, but he did at least play a slightly more positive role than those guys. And he played a slightly more positive role again in the constitution, which William Ruto voted, was William Ruto tried to stop. He tried to vote against the new constitution that came in 2010. So the constitution passed, and that's a good thing, but the fundamental kind of cynical, corrupt politics where parliament will do the bidding of the richest MPs remained. And though that is really the system that the current victory represents, it represents a victory for that brand of doing politics. I'm not sure that an Odinga victory would necessarily have represented a victory for some other, a better brand of politics, but it would probably have opened up space for more progressive space for more for alternatives. It would have been the first non-Kikuyu or Kalenjin leader. He had a broad alliance of other groups from the country. So there was perhaps a possibility that that may have been a more conducive to progressive ideas. So instead what we have is, at the moment, a president-elect who, in order to avoid the ICC, needs to stay in power. And needs to
not. How does his staying in power avoid the ICC?
Well, for the duration of him being in power, at least.
No, but he's not exempt.
No, he's not exempt, but he won't be handed over. I mean, if he, if Odinga was the president, he would most likely be handed over, and the Kenyan state would be after him. As long as he's in control of the Kenyan state, it isn't. Yeah, we have a situation where we have quite corrupt and cynical people in power who have already begun to unleash campaigns against the press, against foreign journalists who've all been told that they need to apply for permits and that there are a lot of their old permissions are no longer valid. We have this campaign against AFRICOG, implicating OSEA as well because of its funding there. So it doesn't look very good. The Supreme Court is going to rule on March the 30th. It may rule a bit later than that because it's the Easter weekend, maybe April the 1st or the 2nd. And there's a certain amount of tension in all the Luo areas in Kisumu, in Mathari, in Kibera, and a little bit on the coast as well. People are all waiting for that judgment. At the risk of being proved wrong, I think that it's likely that because of the complications involved with the petition, because it will be very hard to prove that the even if there are irregularities, that they were of a sufficient magnitude to overturn 600,000 votes, that the court will likely reject the petition and will confirm Uhuru as president. I think the likely response from that will be a propensity to violence in those places that I mentioned, Kisumu, the informal settlements in Nairobi and the coast. And whether or not that actually ticks over into a problem will depend on Odinga's restraint. And now he will come under a lot of pressure, I think, from the international community to talk sensibly, to keep his people calm. And I think that we will see then an acceleration in non-cooperation with the ICC, frustration of ICC activity in Kenya, more intimidation and disappearance of ICC witnesses ahead of the cases in July. I think we'll see more intimidation of the press along the lines that we've already seen, with increasing restrictions on foreign reporting. I think we'll see an increase in the pattern of corruption of the press, where it's become very normal now for editors to take big paycheck, big payoffs from these guys in order not to report things, to bury stories. There's several scandals in the run-up to the election where stories were posted on the Standard website and then were taken off very quickly. So I think we'll see more of that kind of thing, and I expect we'll see a kind of deeper embedding of corruption in wider society, fueled by the corruption that's stemming from Parliament, because keeping all of those MPs happy is an expensive business. And finally, I think we'll see then more pressure on and more restrictions using the NGO laws that are in place to squeeze AFRICOG and all the other sort of progressive institutions, and they will come under increasing intimidation, phone calls, you know, death threats, that kind of thing, which we have seen in 2008-09. There were some people were killed, for example, for reporting on police corruption back then. So I think that sort of thing will continue. I'd love to be proved wrong, but that's the sort of worst case scenario. And I think that, in a way, is the best way of starting to think about how people who are concerned about progressive issues in Kenya might want to respond. So let me stop there. And sorry for talking very quickly. I hope you heard.
Thank you very much. I'm going to open up the floor to questions. We'll take about two or three questions, one go, and then give Ben a chance to ask, to answer. But before I do that, I will take the opportunity to ask the first two. So what are your predictions for the Ruto-Kenyatta relationship going forward? And second, is there a possibility that Parliament will be able to hold the executive in check given the new constitution, if Kenyatta is concerned?
Yeah. I think that Uhuru Odinga and Ruto were best buddies in 2007, and then, of course, they fell out. I think that Ruto will do whatever's best for him. At the moment, I think his best chance of staying out, his main concern is staying out of The Hague, and his best chance of staying out of The Hague is by keeping the Kalenjin firmly behind Kenyatta, making sure Kenyatta gets confirmed, and then making sure that the state is fully behind non-cooperation with the ICC. So that cause is best served by a Kikuyu-Kalenjin alliance for the foreseeable future. In terms of Parliament and the new constitution, I think the new constitution is exciting as a potential. We've seen some progress and some benefits of that in terms of the Chief Justice and in terms of some of the petitions that were brought ahead of the elections, but ultimately they failed, especially the petitions, for example, to stop Ruto and Uhuru from running, because they didn't meet the management and leadership criteria, which is in the Constitution. So they gutted those amendments, those provisions in the Constitution, and then they were allowed to run. So I think there will be probably space for the courts to use the Constitution to make some room. But I think fundamentally, with those guys in charge, it's money that will call the shots.
Okay. Thanks. This is Karen. My question is about the way that the elections happened this past year, and that they seemed that they were peaceful, more peaceful than most of the past elections have been. I've heard some say in the press, including Ocampo, that part of the reason for that was the ICC cases. Do you actually think that that's true?
I don't think either of those statements are true. I think that this was just as violent. The pre-election period, we saw the UN counted 600 dead because of Tana River, because of Samburu, because of other gang violence in Kisumu, other stuff at the coast. We saw 30,000 people displaced in Mandera County because of the governorship thing. So actually what we saw in this pre-election period was a devolution of violence. If your starting point is that political competition in Kenya is violent, the devolution that happened under the constitution devolved violence. So you had more seats, governorship, senate, these new county governments that have resources to spend. And so if you want to control the budget of a county government, you make sure you have enough people, you know, in the council. So I think that that those pre-election numbers were higher than the pre-election numbers for 2007, excluding Mount Elgon. So I don't think that it was necessarily peaceful, and I don't think the ICC had much to do with it. The second part?
That was really the question.
Yeah.
Okay. And if I could ask a follow-up question to that, then I forgot what my question was. I'm sorry, I'll come back to it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mine is kind of looking beyond. If it says the status quo, I think they have a very expensive government. They are like 271 seats in government with the senators, the governors, and all those people. Do you have a sense of the economic implication of the new government, whether it's Raila, whether it's Uhuru, because that's a huge, huge number of people? And then just thinking about it, listening to your history and having lived it myself, I think we are recycling the same people. Is there space for new leaders? Do you see there is space for, because they are there. Mm. Is there space? Is there room for new leaders to emerge? Because as long as we are recycling these guys, they are all related, they are all interlinked. Odinga's father was Uhuru's father's vice president. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the same people. So what's the space for new leadership in Kenya?
Well, the 2007 elections and these elections saw a big turnover in the number of MPs. I mean, quite a lot of people were kicked out. Quite a lot of, some of those have come back again this time. But there are loud young MPs who are trying to make a difference, and there are some loud old MPs like Martha Karua who are trying to make a difference. So I think there is space in there, but they are within a very suffocating system that is so sclerotic with cash and with corruption and impunity that nothing can get done. And economically, I think all of those, because politics is expensive, not just in terms of the salaries of those people, but every time you want to get a bill through Parliament, it costs billions and billions of shillings because they all want payoffs every time.
Mm-hmm.
And as the stakes of those bills and so on increase, especially like the national mechanism, the amounts that the MPs were demanding were really, really high. So I think the economic implications of that system means that we're going to head to, I think, a much more corrupt mafia-style economy, mm-hmm. a la Nigeria. So that's how I see it, really, is that the economy will boom.
Mm.
We've got oil coming into Kano, we've got Lamu pipeline, you know, it's going to be bonanza.
Mm.
But there's going to be this, as long as you don't talk politics, you'll be fine. But if you get involved in politics, it won't be nice.
In terms of if Ruto and Kenyatta are confirmed, in terms of their presence internationally, how do you see that affecting the country being ICC indictees and Kenya being a different country than Sudan is, and how isolated Sudan kind of was, and how that just affects the country, if you think it's really going to have any long-term effect in their relationship with the outside world?
I don't know. I mean, I think you'd be better off asking the Sudan people who followed how that has panned out. I'm pretty cynical about European diplomats. I think they will find a way of working with Kenya. a friend of mine went to a briefing from the UK embassy in Nairobi saying, oh, well, you know, I couldn't meet him, you know, we wouldn't meet him personally, but they'll meet somebody else, you know, they'll just, I don't think we'll see the kind of isolation, the diplomatic isolation of Sudan. They need to do business, they need to, you know, need to work, so I think they'll find a way one somehow, you know.
Sorry, Rachel, let me just ask, London, do you have any questions?
Yeah, Russell. Hi, Ben. Quick question in relation to what you may or may not know about the British Public Affairs Consultancy Agency that came up with the messaging around national sovereignty and was instrumental in putting the Brits in particular in a very difficult place in this whole issue of non-collaboration, non-contact with indictees of the ICC.
I don't know anything about it. I know the I know the story, but I don't know any more than that, I'm afraid.
And the second question relating to the IEBC is the issue of how much, did you have any insights into whether partisan political behaviour or influence inside the IEBC was the critical factor, or was it really, as a number of people, commentators have put it, that basically everybody inside the ICC saw it as their big opportunity, it was their turn to eat, and that's what their focus was, and that's why it was so dysfunctional, that combined with the standoff between the chair and the chief executive?
I don't know, but I think that the money involved in this election means that, you know, there had to be people, there had to be money changing hands there for sure. And you only need to look at the March the 2nd register that was posted ahead of the elections, and then the register that against which they tallied the results are completely different. So definitely there are big problems there, and I would be very surprised if it wasn't the result of cash.
Go ahead, Richard.
Paint a fairly negative picture for SEC prospects. Could they have done anything differently that would have had a different outcome?
I don't think so. No, I think they did. There have been concerns about the cases, and that they, you know, now they had to drop against Muthaura. They had to pull back on some of the others. They dropped the case against the police chief. That they hadn't done their homework properly. But those concerns are slightly different in terms of the politics of how they engaged and how they dealt with Kenya. I think they did it really well. Ocampo came and spoke in the press, talked about what they were trying to do and why they were there, and there was a big groundswell of popular opinion for the ICC that evaporated in the last kind of 18 months. So I think the ICC trod very carefully, and I think it's a real shame that everybody now thinks that international justice is the ICC, when we've got the African Court, we've got all of these, the first international justice. Actually, the first sort of the way I think see it, and the way we talked about it in the Africa division within Human Rights Watch, to counter this negative perception of the ICC as an African court, is that the first international trial was Nuremberg, and then you had ICTY in Yugoslavia, and then you had the mixed tribunal in Cambodia, and Sierra Leone. Then it's Sierra Leone, then it's Rwanda, and then it's the ICC. But actually, there are other international mechanisms there as well, and that's what Kenya should be thinking about. But that narrative is lost now. It's just the ICC and an African court, and go away. And that's a real shame.
I don't think there's any other international mechanism that you could rely on to bring a criminal prosecution. There's no African court which has done anything of that sort that
no.
would have jurisdiction no. To engage in anything like that. So the ICC is the only real possibility. I mean, one question I have is, two questions. One is the status of Kofi Annan's influence in the Kenya situation. It had been quite high at a certain point. Has it completely drained away at this stage? and then the susceptibility of Kenya to international pressure?
Well, Anand, before the election, told Kenyans to think very carefully about who they voted for, and the message was, don't vote for the NDITs. And that went down very, very badly, because Kenyans, you know, quite rightly don't like being told who to vote for. So I think whatever credibility he did have, which he used, you know, I think very wisely and very carefully through 2008, 2009, 2010, to guide the ICC process, and he even talked, he was even issuing advice to the ICC, he was telling Ocampo how to handle it and stuff, which I think was great. But I think he's now been superseded by events because he intervened in that way, and now the election's gone the other way. The lesson for international pressure on Kenya of the 2007 violence was that Kenya is susceptible to international pressure, but only of the highest, most forceful, sustained kind.
I don't think I'm telling stories out of school, but you know, Anand worked the international pressure effort very well then. Just to give you one example, he found that one key player had a child in school in Switzerland. And he was in touch with the Swiss government about revoking the visa as to put pressure on that participant in the process. So he played the game very well during that period. And people are susceptible to a variety of forms of pressure. Having their children go to school in the UK or Switzerland or the United States gets to be important to officials in various countries. So there are mechanisms, what are called smart sanctions, which can be effective.
Yeah, and we saw the impact of that in 2007 and 2008. I mean, I think that's what I was sort of agreeing with you, really, that was fantastic. But it took Anand to bring it all together, to line up the panel of eminent African personalities. We had to have Condoleezza Rice come herself and have a press conference and hold the hands of these two guys. So it was, it took an enormous sustained amount of pressure over a period of about 3 weeks to get them to the table and to cut a deal. The only way that the internationals are going to mobilize on that scale is if there is a concomitant threat to their interests, which really means stability. So I don't think they're going to step up if it's just an internal Kenyan issue or how to get these guys to the ICC. They're not going to actually take major diplomatic steps. It's just going to slide.
You ended your talk about with this idea of those of us who want to support civil society inside Kenya, these issues and this history is obviously really critical. So the question I would have is, what advice do you have for us? I mean, obviously we have OSEA, thankfully, on the ground to help guide us in that, but it seems like a lot of what you're saying is, in essence, it was a rejection of, the vote was in some ways a way to flip the bird to the international community and say, we're Kenyans, we're going to make our own decisions. So obviously international investments need to be done in a really savvy way. So the question is, how do we support Kenyan civil society and local human rights actors without jeopardizing their security or ability to have influence in this environment?
Well, it makes the intervention much more problematic. It means you've got to be so much more delicate and so much more careful about how you intervene. But that doesn't mean that those interventions aren't necessary and aren't useful. And the best guide to that, how to do that, is going to be OSEA and AFRICOG and all of the people who are engaged. We're back, in a way, to 1997, really, when we had a civil society in Kenya that was very much at odds with the state and needed a lot of international support and encouragement. And minor, and all these people, all their careers were formed in that struggle. you know, the guys who are running things now were the young guns back then. The way I see it is it goes sort of back there. There is now a new constitution to play with. There's slightly more independent courts, so they might be able to make a bit of space. But if things go in the sort of negative direction that I suspect, then we will see increasing restrictions, the kind of executive authority that the government can exert, like the NGO registration process and things like that, with journalist permits, you know, that sort of squeezing. But, you know, Kenya remains open for business. They will want the economy to keep growing. They will want NGOs to be based there. They won't want to push them too hard. So I think, you know, the attitude of the Kibaki kind of mafia network, if you like, up till this point has been, as long as you don't threaten our essential interests, there's no problem, quite laissez-faire. And I think that will, you know, that will probably be the case. Until they're out of the ICC woods, they'll be very nervous. But once that's passed, and once they realise that their interests aren't threatened, they can make money, they can control things, you know, I think they'll let it go, probably. It might not be such a major cultural change.
Maybe even one question. What will the donors do? I mean, is Kenya becoming more independent? You say it's becoming very rich, it's got oil and so on. Is it going to be detaching itself from...
Donor money in Kenya is minimal anyway. It's already very, very small at this time. They suspended a lot during the Moi era. They got back in a big way in 2002. And since the economy's been doing so well, and there's been quite a few corruption scandals with DFID's education budget, things like that, they've pulled back, and it's very small now. Kenya's practically an independent country. It shouldn't need it, but there is still a residual amount. But I don't think that will make much difference.
Any more? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry to depress your Friday.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for coming. That was really great. Thank you, Ben.
All right.